Greetings again. This is the Cedar Mill Community Library's next oral history interview of recent immigrants or their family members, done by Sunset High School students. Here we hear Julie Dennis, the daughter-in-law of Hank Dennis, telling about Hank's experiences immigrating here from Poland. So enjoy.
Hi, I'm Marian.
I'm Julia.
I'm Helena.
And I'm Julie Dennis.
Okay, welcome.
Now, the person I'm going to be telling you about is my father-in-law, who came from Poland when he was 12 years old, speaking no English. They made him sit in the kindergarten chairs because the teacher wanted to punish him for not speaking English.
Oh, wow.
And so here's this big 12-year-old pre-teenage guy sitting in these little crappy little chairs. It was totally mortifying to him. And he was pretty well educated because he had to know how to read before he could start kindergarten in Poland, so he was already a good student, and so it was humiliating for him to be treated like a dumb kindergartner.
What year was that?
He came over at 12, and he was born in 1914, so that would be 1926.
Wow.
And he was in Germany during most of World War I because his mother, a Polish woman, had gotten a job working for the German army, or German high command officer thing stuff, and so Hank was actually born in Poland, in Cologne, Germany, even though his mother was Polish and he was considered a Polish national.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very fortunate thing because he acquired polio when he was 2 years old, and if his mama hadn't been working for the Germans, he would have died because there were no doctors in Poland. It was a very lucky thing that she was there. So she stayed quite a while working in that job. And then when he was, when the war was over, they went back to Poland. And then there weren't any jobs there. Poland was just decimated by that war. And so she left him with his relatives, his aunt and uncle. And then she went back to work so she could earn some money, as is true nowadays also. And the relatives that raised him were out in the country, and it was a very poor environment. So at the age of 5, he had to have a job like everybody else. And his job was to go out in the morning with the cow to graze the cow. But there was no place you were allowed to graze your cow because the property all belonged to people. So you had to kind of sneak around and hope that you wouldn't get set upon by the farmers whose pasture you were using. And he would go out in the morning with a crust of bread for the whole day, a little 5-year-old kid, and with his big job to graze the cow. And of course, if he wasn't successful, he would probably get beaten when he got home and stuff. It was a tough life.
Was he affected by World War II at all?
He wasn't able to serve because of his polio. It left him with a permanent injury and a limp. So he worked in the War Department for Continental Motors, building the airplane motors for our planes in World War II.
Okay. For American planes?
Yeah, he was over here by then. It was 1926 when he came over.
And why did they come
over? His mother was in Germany with the 3 kids alone because her husband had already come over to America for greater opportunity. And so they were alone there for years. Then finally, and they didn't even know if he was still alive because there weren't good communications back then. And suddenly he sent some kind of letter or communication or maybe a telegram or something telling them to come and join them in America. So she spoke no English or anything. And so she brought the most needful child with her, and the one with polio, which was Hank. And the older sister turned out to have TB, and so she didn't pass the visa, so she had to be left behind.
Oh, gosh.
And then as soon as they got settled, they sent for Hank's big brother named Roman, and he was healthy enough to come over, so he came over at the age of 14. So those 2 kids were Polish born, and then the next 3 children were born in this country.
Did he ever see his sister again?
Never.
They
tried to communicate with her after World War II because, of course, Poland was in a terrible state in World War II, and she survived the war. And they sent packages to her for many years, and then communication stopped. And at one point, for I think Hank's 60th birthday, we wanted to buy him a trip to Poland to go back and see the old country. And he had no desire. He said, I will never go back there. And even to see his sister, and we didn't know if she was still alive also. So he just said, no way. You can give me the ticket, but I won't go.
Oh my gosh. Where did the family first settle?
The dad originally went through Chicago, and then he settled in Iron Mountain, where there was a lot of opportunity. The dad was Roman Sr., and Hank's brother was Roman Jr., and Roman was I guess you could call him an employment agency. He would get people from the city to come out to the woods, not always voluntarily, I think, if they were drunk maybe, and work in the woods up in Iron Mountain. And they were loggers and lived in logging camps and lived a pretty rough, rustic life. And he would haul truckloads of guys up to the woods to work, and then he'd supervise them and go back and get more when they ran off or whatever. And of course, there were copper mines there too, so it was the land of opportunity. And so he sent for his wife and children to come and join him in Iron Mountain. So they went straight to Iron Mountain, which I have no idea how they got there because they didn't speak any English. And it was scary enough to land in New York and then to find your way to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Mm-hmm. They call it the UP. And the UP was a pretty isolated place to get to also. Mm-hmm. So it must have been a pretty scary endeavor to make that trip.
Especially landing in New York. That's such a huge city, intimidating.
And Ellis Island is pretty scary also. Mm-hmm. So they managed to make it, and then they had three more children here. So, but the grandmother was quite Hank's mother was quite an amazing person. On our first date, my husband was telling me about his amazing, wonderful grandmother, and he said, would I be willing to name, if things went the way he anticipated, this is on our first date, would I be willing to name our first daughter after his grandmother? And I thought that was so romantic. I said, sure, but I didn't know she was Polish.
What is her name?
Victoria Kwiatkowska.
Oh, that's a mouthful.
Well, it means little feminine flower in Polish.
Oh.
Kwiat is flower, and Kowska is little feminine, a diminutive. And so for some years, Victoria would tell people her name was Flower.
Cute. Did Hank ever tell you what his first impressions of landing in the USA were, or
he had a pretty hard life, and I think most of his past he just wanted to suppress. When we would ask him for stories about the war and stuff, and after it was pretty tough for the people alive after the First World War in terms of what happened to that country. I mean, their entire educated class was killed. And so there was nothing left but the peasants and people that weren't educated and stuff. And his memories were also painful, that he had no desire to ever tell stories about them. He would just clam right up. He wore long pants, so for years I didn't know about his limp. And one day, for some reason, he was in shorts or a bathing suit or something. And I was just astonished, because one leg, I couldn't imagine I could walk on it. It was so damaged and deformed from the polio. The ankle was about this thick. And pretty tiny. I mean, and he always walked like a pretty normal person, except when he was very tired. He was a very sweet and gentle man. Not very talkative. Mm-hmm. But he told some good stories when he told them about America, not about Poland or Germany. And he was a pretty unusual guy. He was quite a mushroom hunter. And he had learned in Poland how to collect mushrooms, so he would go out gallivanting in the woods in Michigan. After the war, they ended up living in Muskegon, Michigan. He worked for Continental Motors for a long time after that. And then he opened his own tool and machine shop in Muskegon. And in Grand Rapids, actually, he ended up in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And he had his own tool and die, tool and whatever that word is, machine tool shop. Mm-hmm. And so he was an entrepreneur and made a successful life here. And didn't make a lot of money, but he was grateful for the opportunity he had here to have the amount of freedom he had and the ability to do as he pleased, basically. And so he thought America was a pretty good place. He didn't rave about it, but you couldn't say anything bad about it.
So he grew up speaking German?
German, or? Polish, and English.
Because he was born in Germany to Polish parents.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then he lived back in Poland part of the time, so he kept both languages. And I think he may have spoken Latvian or something else, because I remember my husband can speak some Latvian and some Polish. And then Russian. Oh, he spoke Russian also.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he was, for a farmer kid, he was pretty educated in that sense. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, they had to know how to read before they could even go to kindergarten. They weren't allowed to start school if you couldn't read, for Pete's sake. How could you learn?
Did he ever tell you about, like, facing any sort of prejudice against, like, immigrants in general? Or
and then that's from, like, that incident in the classroom.
That was about the only time he really experienced that. They were in an environment that wasn't in the big city, where the immigrants were treated pretty poorly.
Right.
And because his dad was kind of a boss kind of person in the camp and in the hierarchy, he wasn't high up, but he wasn't at the bottom.
Yeah.
So they had some protection in that sense. And his dad was a pretty rough, tough kind of guy. Yeah, I would say he wouldn't cross that fellow. When the boys, the unusual thing about Hank was that he did the whole two-generation thing in one generation, because he came over here speaking no English, and usually takes the next generation to be able to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
But he and his brother Roman, the two Polish-born kids, both managed to get themselves through Michigan Tech with a bachelor's degree in one generation. And the three kids who were born here never worked that hard or were that successful. They made more money, but they didn't get as educated.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought that was pretty impressive. And he did it by the seat of his pants or whatever. They had been working, saving every penny, and they had accumulated enough to afford college. And he and his brother were going to go off together in a room together. And they went to get their money when they were ready to leave. It was buried somewhere. And the dad had found it and taken it up and spent it all, mostly on drink. And they confronted him. And he said, "What do you mean your money? You're my son's. It's my money." Which in Poland is true, and probably was true back then in this country too. He said, "It doesn't belong to you. It's my money. I can do as I please with it." So they went off to college with $100 between them for the whole year. And they found on the student bulletin board, they registered for class, which was pretty cheap then. And they found on the bulletin board these listings of places, and they couldn't afford any of them. But in talking to someone, he said he knew the shack in the woods that nobody lived in. And so they went in the shack and filled up with the holes, and they managed to string an electric wire from somebody else's electricity, so they had one bulb. And they bought a 100-pound sack of oatmeal, and they lived on that for almost the whole first term.
Oh, one sack of oatmeal.
So they were determined to make a better life than what they had.
Yes.
And I think two other fellows lived with them in the end, so they had like four of them living there, and so probably their body heat kept the place warm.
Exactly.
Pretty small.
Yeah.
And I think they probably spent most of their time on campus. But as far as prejudice goes, they were in an environment where it was mostly hardworking guys without a lot of hierarchy. They were all in it together, and so probably the bosses said rude things to them, like, "Get over here, you dumb Polak," but they said it to all of them. You know, I think it wasn't an issue for them.
Well, I guess,
did he ever come to Oregon?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, in fact, that brings up a very interesting anecdote. Their first visit to us came when we met in Colorado for my husband's younger brother's wedding, so their second son. They had two sons and a daughter, Hank and his wife. And the younger son had asked my husband to be his best man, of course. And I said, "Vic, that's 2 weeks after our first baby's due, and so I wouldn't count on him being there." He said, "Oh, I know, it'll work out." But it was a lot like Hank, just sort of optimistic and take it as you come, and he's, you know, go with the flow. And I said, "Well, okay, but don't count on him." Well, my smart baby came 3.5 weeks early. So by the time of the wedding date, I was back to my normal figure. I wore my beautiful green suit. And we met in Colorado with this beautiful wedding in the mountains, just like Sound of Music, all these peaks and the white dresses and flowers. And it was just gorgeous. And then they drove home with us in our car. They had flown out. And driving home, Hank was back to Oregon through the mountains, and from Colorado here is some pretty rough territory. And he was really quiet the whole trip, and I thought he was upset about something. He just wouldn't talk at all. And finally I said, "Well, you know what, you seem very a little down, you know, what can you tell me what you're thinking?" And he said, "Oh, actually, I'm thinking about what it was like for the pioneers and their wagons to try and cross this kind of land."
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine? Because we were following the wagon track, the same trail almost. And there were places where you can get out and go and see the actual wagon tracks and the rocks. I have no idea how they could get the wagons across this territory. And the thing he educated me about that had never dawned on me was that he said, "Do you know why the women and children always walked beside the wagon?" And I said, "Well, because the fathers of the family were the preeminent people, and so they're the ones that got to ride." And he said, "No, the fathers drove it because there were no springs in the seats, and you were whamming your spine every second for those wooden wheels going around, bang, 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 all day long. And if you were sick and had to lie in the wagon, you would die from the jostling. It was just too whamming on your body. It's just an assault, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours a day on those hard lumber boards of the wagon." So the women and children got the benefit of not having to ride in the wagon and be able to walk in a nice...
Yeah, it is a benefit.
...out of the wagon.
So Oregon fascinated him then in that way with the pioneer
trail. Yes, he thought it was very interesting. And when I went to see the Oregon City Museum, I noticed that they had invented little leather holders for the seats, so they had a little spring to them. So for later wagons, they were improved.
New and improved.
But he knew the Polish version of no springs, and he knew the early pioneers had no springs, and so he identified with them very painfully as we came across all that rough territory. And when you come along the gorge, I mean, you got to wonder how they did it.
Yeah. What are the most important lessons that he's learned in America? I mean, if he's ever told you about that.
To be kind. People weren't very kind in the environment after the Second and First World Wars. And I never saw him do an unkind thing. To value education, they had a dictionary right in the living room on a pedestal stand, just like a library. It was right next to the sofa. So when he was reading and there was a word he wanted to look up, he just turned and opened the dictionary without even having to get up.
Okay.
And it was a big, not a small dictionary, you know, that like 6-inch thick dictionary that had everything in it. And he knew most of those words. And he read mostly nonfiction. I think all nonfiction. So this really abstruse, heavy books I would never plow through past page 6, you know. And he'd read the whole book and tell you what was in it, which is one of the reasons I married my husband, because he has the same gift. He reads these thick books and tells you what's in them. So he was very educated, and you could discuss all kinds of things with him. He was quite a good discusser of things, and he'd share with you what he read and be interested in your opinion and stuff. So I guess you'd call him a pretty serious intellectual for a guy that you know, appeared to be a working kind of guy.
Did he ever talk about how different America was than Poland? Like, did he miss any aspects of Poland or Germany?
I think he didn't miss a single thing about either one of them, because, as I say, he wouldn't go back. And he wasn't a great talker about emotional things, so he never said how much America meant to him. But obviously, if you don't even want to go back and visit your home territory, you've got to pretty much like the country where you are. And he wasn't big on speaking Polish. He kept it up so he could communicate with other people. And at our daughter's baptism, he did the benediction in Polish for us.
That
was kind of cool. That was a funny time, because the family was all together at Vic's wedding, and Victoria was 6 weeks old, so we thought we'd have her baptismal thing the day after the wedding on Sunday. And it was an itinerant traveling minister. So in the little weekly paper for Crested Butte, Colorado, it said, "Dennis' wedding Saturday afternoon," and told all about it. And it said, "Dennis' baby baptism Sunday morning." It wasn't totally clear whose baby it was. That was ours. And some of the people didn't appreciate having the baptism at 8 in the morning, but... Well, I think a lot of the immigrants that came here were especially impressive people, because they just the fact of their arousing themselves out of people's normal inertia to make this horrendous journey over here makes them pretty special people. So it's pretty ironic that they were met with, in the cities especially, all this criticism and insults and degrading treatment and stuff, when they had just shown that they had the American quality of initiative and stick-to-itness and all the kinds of things we value in Americans by virtue of their fact of getting themselves here and such, you know, against such difficult odds. I think immigrants are pretty cool people.
Yes, definitely.
And in fact, these days it seems like they're the only ones who appreciate America.
I know, yeah.
Right, you talk to them and it kind of opens your eyes to this country's values and good elements and aspects, as opposed to all the bad ones people focus on.
We appreciate you being here.
Well, I hope you have a lot of fun with the project. You're probably going to learn a lot of interesting stories.